Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. COVID-19 has now claimed more than 100,000 lives in the U.S., the highest death toll of any country in the world by far. In a tweet this morning, President Trump called it a very sad milestone. For perspective, the first reported death due to COVID-19 in the U.S. came on February 29th.
And the economic toll of the pandemic continues to worsen today as the Labor Department reports another 2.1 million people filed unemployment claims last week, bringing the total since mid-March to more than 40 million, roughly the equivalent of one quarter of the U.S. workforce. Let's bring in Gene Sperling, former director of the National Economic Council under Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. Gene Sperling, welcome back. And this marks the eighth straight week that weekly first-time jobless claims have come down from their peak of nearly 6.9 million in March. But these are still historically very high numbers. What's your takeaway from today's report?
Yeah, we should start with your point, Jeremy, which is the all-time record before the COVID crisis hit was 695,000. So normally when you break a new record, it goes from 695,000 to, let's say, 800,000. Here we're at a place where 2.1 million, three times the all-time record is seen as somewhat better than previous months. So, we're still seeing a dramatically weak job market with, I believe, unemployment is going to be near 20%. And I think when people measure the full degree of harm in the labor market, it's going to be close to 30% of people are either unemployed, are working part-time against their will, or on furlough. And those are staggering depression-like numbers, or numbers we haven't seen since the early 1930s.
Well, and the idea at the beginning of this a couple of months ago was that this was going to be unlike a typical recession because it would be quick and then there would be a quick rebound. But do you get the sense as you watch company after company lay off thousands of workers and millions of workers that those people are all going to get their jobs back in the next few months?
You know, no, I don't. And I think there's a lot of people trying to focus on, well, in a few months, jobs numbers will be kind of positive. Well, look, if you're watching a basketball game and your team falls behind 50 points in the second quarter, yeah, if it comes up five, if they, you know, make up 5 points or 10 points in the third quarter, I guess they've done better, but your team is still dramatically behind. And so what we're talking about is having an economy where we're partially reopening. But I think you don't have to be an economist. It's common sense. You look at the nail salon, you look at the restaurant, you look at people in the travel industry, and you know opening up means partial reopening. And so I think what is very scary and should be alarming is that if we don't continue to take this seriously with major aid to states, to small businesses, with unemployment insurance that goes on as long as necessary and helps families keep the lights on and pay their bills. If we don't do this, I think we could have a period of sustained double-digit unemployment that could go on for quite a long time. A lot of this is within our power, but we've got to stop thinking that when you're down 50 points and you get a few points back, you're doing okay. You're not. We have to continue to take this seriously. Remember, in the Great Recession, what 10% was the highest it hit, and we all rightly thought that was terrible. To have an economy where it goes on at 12, 14%, maybe better than it is today in this month, but it's going to be very painful and harmful for our economy. Small businesses will close forever. And what worries me the most is families that could have just, you know, pushed through that with enough support could suffer devastating personal harm, and we don't need to let that happen.
Well, so on a scale between being too cautious right now and opening up too quickly on the other end, where do you think we are as a country?
You know, opening up should be the least ideological thing in the world. It should just be basic common sense, because it's not an ideological question. Every one of us can make that decision themselves. If you tell somebody to put out an open sign on their restaurant or their store, but people don't have the confidence to come in, or they see behavior that's leading to a surge of new cases, or a loved one has to go to the hospital, they're going to pull back. So ultimately, you have to open up in a way that gives consumers confidence that they can re-engage with the economy to some degree, and workers confidence that they can work safely. And you just have to do the hard work.
We've got to leave it right there, Gene Sperling, but we've got your point there. That is Gene Sperling, former director of the National Economic Council. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
To Sweden now. Remember, early on in the pandemic, while other Scandinavian countries imposed strict lockdowns, Sweden pretty much left it up to Swedes to socially distance, saying proudly they would. But kids are still going to school, bars and restaurants are open, and it didn't work. The country has a population of 10 million, and so far infection and death rates are much higher than other Scandinavian countries on a per capita basis. The BBC's Maddie Savage joins us from Stockholm on Skype. And Maddie, the strategy, we understand, was developed by some government scientists along with officials. So how are they defending what are now more than 4,000 deaths?
So debates are starting to intensify here in Sweden about what exactly has gone wrong in the country, why there are so many deaths. But I think it's also very important to point out that trust in the Swedish Public Health Agency and the government is historically high in Sweden. And I think there are two key things to focus on here. The first is that voluntary social distancing that you talked about. In terms of the numbers of people that are working from home, usage of public transport is down compared to typically. I watch empty buses go past my window in the suburbs every day. But then you can juxtapose that with the fact that bars are still open, people are still going there, people are starting to gather in larger groups in parks as the weather gets better. And there is some data to suggest that people are being a bit less cautious in terms of their movements than they were at the start of the pandemic. But I think when you speak to officials here, they're largely quite impressed with the way Swedes have taken to voluntary social distancing. What they say is the main issue here is the fact that COVID-19 has got into so many care homes. This has been an issue across Europe and much of the world, but in Sweden, that's really been what officials believe is a key reason why the death toll is so much higher here than in other Scandinavian countries who've had a smaller proportion of deaths in care homes.
Well, some people make the point that if you have lockdowns, you have less chance of people who go visit nursing homes or people who work in nursing homes, bringing in infections, because in general, you have fewer infections in your population. But you mentioned that, people are starting to go out. You produced a video for the BBC, and we'll have a link at herenow.org. But you went to bars and restaurants. Here's one of the people you met.
Hey, my name is Isaac. I'm 22 years old, and I'm enjoying a beer in the sun with my friends here in Stockholm. Cheers.
He's not wearing a mask, neither are his friends. On the one hand, you say there is voluntary social distancing, but what else was supposed to happen? I mean, nothing seems to have been closed.
It's so fascinating to be living here and for my new normal to be so different to other people's new normals around the world. As you say, masks are not mandatory here. That's not something that's been advised by the government. Certainly on warmer days, groups of young people and older people are definitely going out and mingling. And you raised the point about how that may have potentially affected COVID-19 getting into care homes. I interviewed the daughter of somebody who had died in a care home, and she said that she felt violated in a way, that the care home workers had been taking their kids to football, potentially going out to restaurants, and then coming in and treating her father. There's also been shortages of protective equipment here, as in other countries. But I think there are really important cultural factors to take into account here. One of those is the trust in authorities and the government. And the fact that Swedes in some ways do social distancing better than others most of the time. This isn't a place where if you go to the pub, you'd necessarily mingle and make friends with new people. If there was a sports game on the TV or if you got on a bus, you'd sit next to a stranger and have a chat with them. That's something you might do in the US, in the UK, but it's really frowned upon here in Sweden. You don't even stand close next to somebody at a bus stop. So in some ways, there are these cultural factors that have contributed to voluntary social distancing, but it's certainly a very mixed picture. And when you do put it in the context of having a much higher death toll than its Scandinavian neighbours, that's when I think it does look very stark that those places that chose stricter lockdowns have managed to keep the death toll down much more than here in Sweden.
And just quick, what do you think is going to happen? Because this is not a virus that respects the notion that, you know, people maybe aren't as friendly and don't sit next to somebody on a bus. If you still are standing in the aisle next to someone, you know, you can get something. Do you think that there's going to have to be a big change there? Maybe a lockdown, maybe closing schools.
I think that's incredibly unlikely based on what the authorities and ministers have said so far. But I think the care homes is really the key focus of the debates here in terms of where things really went wrong.
The BBC's Maddie Savage from Stockholm, Sweden. Maddie, thank you.
Thanks very much for having me.
In his new book, journalist and anthropologist Scott Carney writes, humans love comfort to the point of absurdity, and as a result, we're crippled with anxiety, autoimmune conditions, fatigue, loneliness, and a generalized sense of unease. His solution is to learn how to tolerate being uncomfortable, and he does so in some very unusual ways in his book, which is called The Wedge, Evolution, Consciousness, Stress, and the Key to Human Resilience. Scott Carney, welcome to Here and Now.
Jeremy, thanks for having me on.
Well, and first, explain what you mean by the wedge.
So the wedge is essentially separating stimulus from response in the body. So putting yourself in a stressful situation, such as ice water, something that demands all of your attention, and then choosing what your body does in that stressful reaction. So your natural response in ice water would be to clench up and fight that stimulus and instead relax and let your body find a different way to heat itself. And what I've learned is that if you're able to put yourself under lots of different sorts of physical stresses and that give you really loud sensations that tell your body to do something automatically, we have a certain ability to intervene, which gives us not only physical resilience, but also emotional resilience.
How do you get yourself in a, let's say, a very cold pool of water to not feel like you're freezing and going to die if you stay in there for that long?
We're addicted to comfort in America, right? And in the West in general. And we have this idea that if we just insulate ourselves from the variations of the environment, that's sort of like how to keep ourselves safe and cozy. But that's not where we evolved from, right? We grew up in the constant varying temperatures in the plains of Africa, and we were used to dealing with extremes. So when you jump into an ice bath, you might get that signal of imminent death, but it's because we in general don't expose ourselves to stressors anymore. And what you find is that once you do it, once you actually, let's say you're just taking a cold shower, it's more difficult to turn the knob to cold than it is to sit under the actual cold water. So it's really your emotions that are getting in the way and not really the cold from the environment.
Well, and to your point about, the plains of Africa, whereas we used to use things like anxiety and fear based on like some animal chasing us, we now will use it and get really worried and anxious about a meeting that's coming up tomorrow at the office or something like that.
The lion example is great, right? You know, that's when the threat was real. There's a lion, let's say it's running at you, and your body is primed to respond, right? You're going to dump adrenaline to give you energy. You're going to dump cortisol. That's going to lower your, you know, increase your pain threshold. And your body is there to go into fight or flight. You're going to deal with that response with a physical activity. Now, when you fast forward into the modern world, we're not fighting lions, right? The threats are now sort of remote. you know, they're almost existential. And, you know, if you're fretting over your 401k or worried about your N95 mask or whatever it is you're doing, you're still releasing those stress hormones into your body. And those hormones have no place to go. And they make you feel anxious. They make you feel sort of overwhelmed. So what I'm trying to do and what I'm trying to suggest is that there's ways to give yourself stimuli that are appropriate for that adrenaline when you release it. And managing yourself under physical stress, that gives you emotional resilience.
So you have decided to try out a lot of different things in this book to sort of get in touch with yourself and change the way your body responds to your surroundings, including an exercise involving kettlebells. Tell me about that and what you did there, why you did that.
Yeah, this has been like the most amazing discovery for me because the kettlebell section sort of started with me hanging out at a neuroscience lab at Stanford where I'm swimming with virtual sharks in a shark tank, which the neuroscience behind it was really interesting because I wanted to control myself in a fearful situation. But there's something about videos of sharks that just don't like trigger those automatic emotions in me. So I was walking out of Stanford's like basically front doors when I get this call from a friend of mine in the Bay Area who said, Scott, you got to go hang out with my friend Michael Castrogiovanni, who's going to throw kettlebells at you and going to put you into an instantaneous flow state, which I think probably gets the award for the lamest text message ever, you know? but I had this feeling, I was like, okay, I'm going to give it a try. And I meet this guy, Michael, and he's holding what amounts to a weapon in his hand. Like, it's a cannonball, right? It's this big piece of metal, and he's going to throw it at me. And in this moment, I realize that I have that stimulus that's going to make me really, really scared. And the ritual with kettlebell throwing goes like this. You know, he looks at your eyes and he swings it once in the air and you're looking at each other. And then on the second swing, he doesn't let go. Instead, you shift your eyes to that thing, which is definitely going to fall on my foot in a second, right? And on the third swing, it flies through the air and my hand just sort of automatically grasps the handle as it floats through the air, and I throw it back to him. And now this fearful sensation, because everyone's thinking, oh my God, you are going to break your foot. You're going to break your knee. It's going to hit you, right? But what happens is the movement is so simple and the danger is so obvious that you have to pay attention to it, that instead our movements start coordinating automatically. And we go from being in this fearful state to essentially dancing with kettlebells. And I realize that this is ultimately about trust by creating a threat that forces the attention that your body can give it. And it becomes this really beautiful practice.
But does something like that have a lasting impact on the way that you see the world or interact with people?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt once said, you know, do one thing every day that scares you. It's pushing your boundaries, right? The first time you throw the kettlebell or catch a kettlebell, it's such a powerful stimulus going from fear into joy that you will remember that. If you see a couple throw a kettlebell, usually they're terrible at it at first. These trust things come out in their movements. And so the guy who invented this says that it's like couples therapy to watch this happen. They learn, you know, usually very quickly to communicate physically without words because you're facing something that's visceral and then you're modulating it and realizing that this can be fun. This can be a joyful experience.
There are so many other things you talk about in this book as you sort of went through a journey of trying to get in touch with yourself in a number of different ways, including eating only potatoes and breathing exercises, but also some drugs. And I want to talk to you about one of them because I'm just curious about your experience with it, which is you in this book, you go to South America, as some people do, to take ayahuasca.
Yes.
Tell me what was the purpose of that experience and what was it like?
So throughout the whole book, I am putting myself in very loud situations, like things that command my attention. And, you know, ayahuasca is a thing that a lot of people are talking about right now, right? It's this hallucinogen that releases this chemical called DMT, and then it modulates that chemical by making it last a really, really long time in your mind. But
apparently a lot of people in Silicon Valley, a lot of the big names in Silicon Valley like to try ayahuasca. It's been reported.
Right. Well, no, it's definitely true. And it gives you a different perspective on things. But you can think about a wedge as just a stimulus outside your body, for instance, the ice bath. But the other place you can, one other place you can put the wedge is actually in your synaptic pathways, in the chemicals that actually transmit messages in your brain. For me, I wanted to connect with the universe. I had these huge questions about, you know, God, about spirituality, about who am I as a person. But instead, what ayahuasca showed me, you know, it was basically like a counselor. Like it sort of showed up and you sort of talk to it almost like an external thing. It's very strange. And the shamans would say you're talking to the spirit of the plant. But it might just be your own psychology. The challenge is to remain in control, right? The fear is that you're going to go mad and you're never going to come back and you're never going to be the same. And what you're trying to do is make that change happen in a beneficial way. And I wouldn't recommend ayahuasca to everyone, but it is something that if you're called to it, it can be very, very powerful and very, very transformative. And for me, I ended up kicking an addiction because of it.
Hmm. Interesting. You take a lot of risks in this book. You say that we all should be taking more risk, that there's a risk to not taking risk. What are the kind of risks that you think that we as Americans in particular ought to be taking more?
We need to move outside of our comfort zones. You know, in Latin, there's this idea, memento mori, and it's something that we've lost in this culture. And instead, we avoid it. And in your nervous system, avoidance of death, you know, is good, right? That's what allows us to pass on our genes. But ignoring it, it makes us not take risks. And if you don't take risks, you don't grow and you can't find out what you are capable of. And I think that our tendency is to be numb, right? We want to be comfortable. We want to insulate ourselves. And when we do that, we exist in a narrower and narrower range of where we're able to feel comfortable. If we instead give ourselves strong signals, which is not to say dangerous. Like, I don't want you to hurt yourself, but I want you to expand the ability for you to act in the world. And realizing that sensations, the things that we feel, are guideposts for how we act in the world, but they are not the commands. You don't need to live your life jumping out of airplanes and doing crazy drugs all the time and only looking for the loud signal, but you do need to be capable of facing that loud signal. And that's what I think is the you know, secret to life.
That is Scott Carney, who is a journalist, an anthropologist, and the author of the new book, The Wedge: Evolution, Consciousness, Stress, and the Key to Human Resilience. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Migrants living in the United States send hundreds of billions of dollars every year to friends and families living in other parts of the world. India and China receive the largest share of that money, followed by Mexico, which depends heavily on remittances. We have two stories now from both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border, starting with Matthew Casey from KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Phoenix.
Cristina Coronel paints houses and apartments for a living. She gets paid by the day, and before the virus hit Arizona, she often worked 6 days a week.
Pero pues ahorita no, ahorita pues nada más dos o tres días.
Coronel says her workload has been cut by half, maybe more. She still has to feed her family, pay rent, and bills. She says she used to send her mom between $30 and $50 about once a week, but that's a lot harder now.
Se siente mal. Uno se siente como impotente, ¿verdad?
It feels bad, she says, and makes you feel powerless. If work doesn't pick up again soon,
y pues yo creo que vender mis cosas.
I'll sell my things, she says, maybe a ring, a chain, or a TV. Money transfer businesses hope that migrants will find ways to send money. They have in previous crises, says Liz Alicea Velez, head of the Americas for MoneyGram International. The company reported a $21.5 million loss for the first quarter as a result of lockdowns across the globe.
This was unprecedented because there were so many countries that either were totally shut down or they were severely shut down.
The flow of money into Mexico has been affected by people losing their jobs, says Alicia Velez. But right now, exchange rates still favor senders, who watch the market closely.
So that they can send at the right time, so that their family members can get more pesos for their dollars.
And who depends on those pesos? My colleague, Rodrigo Cervantes, reports from Mexico City.
Teresa Flores is a 69-year-old widow who lives in the state of Guanajuato, Mexico. medicina para comer, para...
Flores says she gets by on the money her daughter in Arizona sends her to buy medicine and food. When times are good, she gets about $40 a week.
Porque, pues, si no hay trabajo, no hay dinero.
No job, no money, she says. Her daughter already told her that tough times are coming because of a pandemic.
No, del gobierno no estoy recibiendo nada.
She says the government is not providing any relief, except for some groceries she says are unfit to eat. Dilip Ratha is the World Bank's lead economist on remittances. He says family and local economies in both sides of a border are damaged by leaving migrants without economic relief during the pandemic. Countries depending on remittances like Mexico might fall into an economic crisis, while the U.S. relies on labor from immigrants being left unprotected.
They are people, so they need to be helped. They need support.
Ratha says 2019 was a record high year for remittances globally, with $554 billion. But we are about to witness the sharpest decline of remittances in history.
We expect migrants to lose jobs and also lose incomes. And that would translate into a decline in remittance flows by 20% in 2020.
And in Mexico, Ratha says people like Teresa Flores, who depend on money from relatives in the U.S., will be hit hard.
If remittances don't come and there is a rupture, they would fall into poverty and they might have malnutrition.
For Here and Now, I'm Rodrigo Cervantes in Mexico City.
AIDS activist, AIDS survivor, and writer Larry Kramer died yesterday at 84. Attention should be paid. In the early 1980s, Kramer was an early voice screaming for attention to the AIDS epidemic. For those who think reaction to COVID-19 has been slow, there was none to AIDS early on because in the beginning it mostly affected young gay men. So people hid their sick adult children in back rooms where they died alone. In 1981, Kramer founded the Gay Men's Health Crisis to help those suffering. He was removed a year later, accused of being too aggressive. Undaunted, he would go on to found ACT UP, the organization that demonstrated against the inaction, staging die-ins to dramatize the toll that AIDS was taking. Kramer also used his skills as a writer. His most famous work was his 1985 play, The Normal Heart, which dramatized the rise of AIDS and his struggles with the gay men's health crisis. It was made into an Emmy Award-winning HBO film starring Mark Ruffalo as Ned Weeks, a stand-in for Larry Kramer. In this scene, with Julia Roberts as his doctor, Weeks is at first reluctant to become an activist.
Dr. Brookner, no one with half a brain gets involved with gay politics. There's no room for criticism.
What's your criticism?
I hate that we play victim when many of us, most of us, don't have to.
Then you're exactly what's needed now. Maybe they're just waiting for someone to lead them.
I don't want to lead them. What exactly are you trying to get me to do?
Tell gay men to stop having sex.
Well, Larry Kramer did tell gay men to stop having promiscuous sex to slow the spread of this sexually transmitted disease. And it was an often unpopular stand.
For every one of those, there's a kid who rushes up to me on the street and says, thank you for saving my life. And that just makes me want to cry. So that makes it all worth it.
Kramer himself was diagnosed with HIV, the virus that caused AIDS, in 1988. But he forged on, often with the fury that saved lives, until his death yesterday from pneumonia. Quite a legacy, quite a life, coming to an end. And now, lives really just beginning.
Goodbye, Mom. Goodbye to you, too.
Well, every year, we take time to celebrate graduates or young people just moving on with Tom Rush's glorious rendition of Canadian Murray McLaughlin's child's song, A Bittersweet Goodbye to Parents. But wait, this year graduation's postponed. Many young people aren't moving on, they're moving back home. Well, we're going to play it anyway, so gather the family, get some tissues. But first, a check-in with Tom Rush, who actually fought off COVID-19 himself. Tom, how are you feeling?
I'm doing great. It was not fun. I cannot recommend it. Don't get it if you can possibly help it. But for me, it was a couple of weeks of feeling really crummy, and I'm better now.
Oh, and we're so glad, because that would have put me over the edge. Look, this is also this idea of COVID-19 and people not making it, you know, giving an aching poignancy to a lot of homes as well. You know, parents and children have left us for good. Talk about this song, which we're going to play, which again, tissues. McLaughlin wrote it in the 60s as a letter to his own parents. You first released it.
I think it's a wonderful, wonderful song because it is so honest. I've wondered sometimes over the years why more artists haven't recorded it. And it's a hard song to do because it is so honest. You cannot hide behind string sections or screaming guitars or anything like that. It's just, you got to be out there. It took me about 6 months to be able to get through it without bursting into tears myself.
Hmm. Well, as I said, we're going to hear it. But Tom Rush, when do we hear you, an artist in this moment we could really use?
I'm going to start doing virtual concerts from home. If you go to tomrush.com and sign up for the email list, you'll be the first to know when that is actually going to happen. I don't have a date yet.
Well, thank goodness. Meantime, stay well, Tom Rush. And here is the performance he did just for us that we play every year, Child Song.
Goodbye, Mama, and goodbye to you too, Pa. Little sister, you'll have to wait a while to come along. And goodbye to this house and all its memories. We just got too old to say we're wrong. And I've got to make one last trip to my bedroom. Guess I'll have to leave some stuff behind. It's funny how the same old crooked pictures, they just don't seem the same to me tonight. There ain't no use in shedding no more tears, Ma. There ain't no use in shouting at me, Pa. I can't live no longer with your fears, Ma. I love you, but that hasn't helped at all. Cause each of us must do the things that matter. And all of us must see what we can see. Though it was long ago, you must remember, you were once as young and scared as me. And I don't know how hard it is yet, Mama, when you realize you're growing old. I know how hard it is now to be younger. I know you've tried to keep me from the cold. And thanks for all you've done, it may sound hollow. But thank you for the good times that we've known. But I must find my own road now to follow. You will all be welcome in my home. I've got my suitcase, and I must go now. I don't mind about the things you said. I'm sorry, Ma, I don't know where I'm going. Remember, little sister, look ahead. And tomorrow I'll be in some of the sunrise. Maybe I'll have someone at my side. Mama, give your love back to your husband. Father, you have taught me well. Goodbye. Goodbye, Mama, and goodbye to you too, Pa.
Okay, we wiped some tears, and now in honor of all grads, our annual celebration of the grads at our mothership, WBUR in Boston, from High School Tyler Barolo, Emily Burbo, Ari and Ravi Eaton, Liliana Lines, Dylan Liriano, Annie Macbeth, Christina Rose Murphy, Lou Paris, Catherine Shea Ryan, I remember when you were born, Simone Siner, Katie Stefani, and Alexis Stopi. Then from college, Elizabeth Brown, Frank Hernandez, Alana Humison, our intern, Lindsay Jeffrey, Nick and Margot Kaminsky, Eileen Levine, Gabriel Lubbock, Maggie Mata, Sarah Rollins, another intern, Kuliani Saxena, Catherine Simpson, Kaya Williams. And applause to those getting advanced degrees, Jackie and Tom Andriano, Nathan Baranski, and our station relations officer, we salute Kuyana Scott Ferguson. You may all feel grounded now, but we know you're going to fly.
Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee for president, says he hopes to name his vice presidential pick by August 1st. At a fundraiser last night, Biden also says his vetting committee hopes to complete the vetting process by July. There are a lot of factors to consider, so let's consider them with Democratic strategist Jamal Simmons. Hi, Jamal.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. So Biden says it will be a woman, and some of his likely considerations at this point include Senators Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren. There's also Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Congresswoman Val Demings, and former Georgia lawmaker Stacey Abrams. Am I leaving anybody out on that list that you think has a real shot?
Those are the big names that I'm hearing. I'm sure there's always a name in the mix that nobody's talking about, but that list sounds pretty good to me.
Okay, so he is under pressure at this point to select a woman of color, and in an interview with CNN earlier this week, Biden was asked if he would do so. Here's what he said.
There are women of color under consideration, and there are women from every part of the country under consideration, because there's a lot of really qualified women that are ready to be president. But I'm not making that commitment. I'm going to make that judgment after, in fact, this group goes through interviewing all these people.
Jamal, do you think that Biden ought to pick a woman of color?
I think a lot of African-American women do, particularly younger ones. I interviewed Karine Jean-Pierre, who is now for my show, This Is FYI, on Facebook and Instagram. I interviewed her before she joined the Biden campaign last week, and she was adamant that Black women should be strongly considered. I think there are a lot of African-American women who feel like they helped deliver the nomination to Joe Biden, and so he should be their candidate. But I think there's an age limit on that, because I tell you, as I call around and I talk to people who are older who don't live in Washington or New York or Los Angeles, and they're concerned, people just want to get rid of Donald Trump. And sure, they would love for there to be an African-American woman nominee. But I think they'd also be comfortable if there wasn't, if Biden was making other commitments from a programmatic stance to take care of the African-American community.
The other thing that has been thrown around is that Biden has to pick somebody from the progressive left, a la Elizabeth Warren. What do you think about that calculation to try to at least energize some of the Bernie Sanders supporters that did not vote for Biden in the primary?
So my experience from the primary is that there are some Bernie Sanders supporters he may never be able to do enough to get. But there are people who are wooable. And for those voters, I think they don't necessarily need it to be in the form of a person, although that would be helpful. Elizabeth Warren obviously would be helpful. But certainly in terms of programs, and it sounds like Joe Biden is trying to do that. You know, he's put Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the congresswoman from New York, he's put her on a environmental committee to help figure out his climate change policy. He's been adopting some questions around education, and he's got Elizabeth Warren that apparently he's talking to every week, whether she's the nominee or not. It seems like she's influencing him from a policy perspective. The question at this point, I think after the coronavirus, what I hear from Democrats the most, not just the most ideologically loud, the ones who are on Twitter and Instagram, but the ones who vote traditionally, is if we win this election, the government's a mess. Joe Biden needs somebody who can help him fix the country and could step in and be president at a moment's notice.
So then what about some of the other people who've been talked about who come from swing states like Michigan and even Georgia? This year could be a swing state. Governor Gretchen Whitmer has been talked about, and so has Stacey Abrams.
Stacey Abrams has, and she's one of the most phenomenal politicians in the Democratic Party. I think whether she's the VP pick or not, she'll either be the governor of Georgia or a cabinet secretary going forward. Nothing but bright things in her future. Gretchen Whitmer, who's from my home state in Michigan, look, she may capture some of what people are yearning for when they look at Andrew Cuomo on television every day. Somebody who is managing the coronavirus, who understands what we're really facing. And as we go into a fall where the virus may come back and resurge and into next year, having a partner who understands the nuance of what states and localities need is also important. So I think that she is on that list for a really important reason. And there's a racial bank shot for people who are interested in racial process. Garland Gilchrist, who's the lieutenant governor of Michigan, I interviewed him on This Is FYI, could end up being the governor of Michigan. Michigan could have the first African-American governor if Gretchen Whitmer is picked as the nominee. There's a drawback, though. What happens if people feel as if Michigan's still wrestling its way through the virus and they want Governor Whitmer to stay on top of it and stay in the state? So you could argue for or against any of these candidates. That gets you back to the place where if you're Joe Biden, you need somebody who could step into the presidency immediately. And I think Democrats would be willing to give him some leeway to figure that out, especially because he's already said if he's president, he's going to pick an African-American woman to be his next Supreme Court nominee. So there are other things that he can do to help let people in the coalition know he's going to take care of them.
That's Democratic strategist Jamal Simmons. Jamal, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
And Robin, you know, both political conventions are less than 3 months away right now, and we have no idea what they're going to look like.
Book a room, don't book a room, whatever.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It is Here Now.